From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. There are only two stages to go in the Tour de France, but more subplots than you can shake a derailleur at. Ahead on Only a Game, a tour update, also a front row look at Mr. Baseball on the eve of his induction into the Baseball Hall of Fame, and a conversation with Larry Durker, author of This Ain't Brain Surgery, How to Win the Pennant Without Losing Your Mind. Also ahead on Only a Game, remembering the first feature story, which ran on our very first program 10 years ago.
My dad said, you're Irish, you're Catholic, and you drink a lot. You're going to go far in the Red Sox organization.
Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Artillery shells struck a church near Monrovia today. Witnesses say at least 15 people were killed. The church had been crowded with refugees fleeing the rebellion in the Liberian capital. Rebels have waged a two-month battle to drive President Charles Taylor from power. Yesterday, President Bush ordered three Navy ships of Marines to position themselves off the coast of Liberia. There's been mixed reaction to that news. The BBC's Paul Welsh reports from Monrovia.
The Liberian government is welcoming the news that America is sending troop-carrying ships to the coast. The people are wondering whether the Marines are going to get off the ships and do anything. George Bush has said only that they'll give support to a West African peacekeeping force, which is trying to get here for some time next week. The United Nations Secretary General and ordinary Liberians caught up in the deadly battle for their capital city want America to lead the peacekeeping force and to put a sizable number of troops on the ground as soon as possible. Liberia's President Charles Taylor has promised to leave the country when peacekeepers are in place.
The BBC's Paul Welsh reporting from Monrovia. Explosions and gunfire were heard in Baghdad today, but there were no reports of any casualties among U.S. troops. U.S. officials say they continue to capture forces opposed to the U.S. presence in Iraq. Yesterday, several men were detained near the former Iraqi president's hometown of Tikrit, suspected of belonging to Saddam Hussein's bodyguard unit. Also yesterday, officials showed journalists the bodies of two men they said were Saddam's sons, killed last week in an attempt to convince Iraqis of their deaths. President Bush meets next week with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon on Middle East peace efforts. He met yesterday with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas and promised to expand U.S. economic ties with the Palestinians. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay plans to visit the Middle East this weekend, in part, he says, to show his strong support for Israel. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
On the trip, the Texas Republican will meet with Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. DeLay said the trip is not intended to undermine the so-called roadmap to peace that the White House is supporting, a strategy that President Bush first outlined in June of 2002.
I think the speech that the president made last year and is adhering to through the roadmap is the right approach. I'm very concerned, and I want to make sure that Israel understands, the Israeli people understands that their fight is our fight, and we're standing shoulder to shoulder with them.
DeLay is expected to be in the region for 8 days. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, Washington.
Officials in the eastern Indian state of Bihar fear a second wave of floods as heavy rains have drenched the region in the past 3 days. At least 34 people have died in floods in the past 2 weeks. This is NPR News. A herd of wild elephants went on a rampage in northern Bangladesh yesterday. According to reports, about 25 elephants, apparently looking for food, came down from the mountains along the border with India and tore through two villages. Two men were trampled to death. About a dozen thatched huts were destroyed. The president of Argentina yesterday vacated a decree that had prevented the extradition of former military officers suspected of torture or murder in the 70s and 80s. Patricia Nazario reports from Buenos Aires.
President Néstor Kirchner overturned the long-standing decree one day after an Argentine judge ordered 46 people arrested. Warrants from Spain charged the group of 45 former military officers and one civilian with human rights abuses during Argentina's dirty war, which lasted from 1976 to 1983. Argentina's Justice Minister Gustavo Belis says Kirchner's move strengthens the principle of equal rights before the law. Spanish law prosecutes genocide even if the violations were committed in other countries. Spanish judges are going after dozens more in Argentina. Human rights groups say as many as 30,000 people vanished during the dirty war. For NPR News, I'm Patricia Nazario in Buenos Aires.
Hundreds of homes in Montana are in danger from a wildfire burning in Glacier National Park. At least six houses along the western edge of the park have burned. Thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes. The fire already has consumed 14,000 acres. It's one of seven major wildfires in the state. According to the National Interagency Fire Center, at least 42 large wildfires are burning in 12 western states. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Lance Armstrong goes into today's Stage 19, the Tour de France's penultimate stage, with a 1 minute, 5 second lead over Jan Ulrich. Many believe today's time trial will determine who will first cross the finish line on the Champs-Élysées tomorrow. Here to help us understand why the current leader may not be the eventual winner is Andy Hood, who covers the Tour de France for Velo News. He joins me now on the line from Saint-Moxent-l'École. Hello, Andy.
Bonsoir de France.
Just don't ever make me say that again. Many are predicting that after today's time trial, Jan Ulrich will be wearing the yellow jersey. Why is that, since Lance has been leading for so long?
Well, Jan is one of the world's best time trialists when the racers go out on the course one at a time, and it's a race against the clock. So it's the strongest man to cross the line. And Ulrich actually beat Lance in a time trial earlier in the tour, took out 1 minute and 36 seconds on Armstrong, in actually Armstrong's worst defeat ever in a time trial on the Tour de France. So it's going to be a duel between Big Jan and Big Tex.
Now, why is it that some riders excel in the time trial? There's no kind of strategy, teammates helping, that sort of thing, when it's just one guy against the clock?
That's right. The time trial is called the race of truth because it comes down to who's the strongest. In a flat stage or a mountain stage, even a time trial, a rider can ride on the wheel of a teammate, which reduces the drag against the wind, and it makes it up to 20-25% easier to ride. In yesterday's stage, a flat stage on Friday, Armstrong stayed tucked away in the bunch, and it was a relatively easy day in the saddle for him. But today, in a time trial, it's going to be Ulrich and Lance just going as hard as they can, as long as they can.
During Monday's Stage 15, Armstrong suffered a bad fall, after which Jan Ulrich stopped and waited until Lance Armstrong got up and began riding again, and later Ulrich said, quote, "If I would have won this race by taking advantage of someone's bad luck, then the race was not worth winning." Is this kind of sportsmanship characteristic of the Tour and of bike racing in general?
It really is, because cycling is one of the most grueling sports. And a racer wants to win on the merit of their performance, not on a mechanical problem a racer might have or a fall in that case. So Ulrich did the right thing. In fact, he returned the favor to Armstrong because 2 years ago, Ulrich was coming down the treacherous Col de Parsoir, and he crashed. He flew off the road going about 60 miles an hour, toppled into a ditch. And Armstrong at the time slowed down, told the other riders to wait for Jan. They weren't sure if Jan was going to be racing or not, but they did the right thing and waited, and Jan returned the favor.
Is there any chance that come the finish line, Jan Ulrich regrets waiting for Lance Armstrong?
Well, that's an interesting question. There's a scenario that's floating around right now that perhaps the race might come down to a few seconds going into Paris on Sunday. typically the final stage, the race is usually decided in the final time trial today.
Mm-hmm.
But perhaps this would be just a few seconds difference, maybe 5 or 10 seconds. And people are asking the question, will Armstrong and Ulrich race into Paris? I mean, of course they're going to race. There's the final stage, and it usually ends with 10 laps on the Champs-Élysées, and the sprinter-type riders take over and fight for the stage victory. But at the end of every stage in the Tour, there are time bonuses, 20 seconds for first, and it goes down to less 20, 12, and 8 seconds. And there's also time bonuses on course. There's two intermediate sprints where 6, 4, and 2 seconds. So mathematically, you can make up a few seconds on the course. It's highly unlikely. It's never happened in Tour history, but this has been one strange Tour, so you never know.
So that's kind of what maybe connoisseurs of this event are hoping for, an honest-to-goodness tight finish at the end.
That's right. Connoisseurs have been loving this Tour from the start. The closest Tour in history was 8-second victory by Greg LeMond in 1989, when on the last day of the Tour, he overcame a 50-second deficit to Laurent Fignon in a time trial. The time trial comes today instead of Sunday, but we have the makings of a classic.
Though everyone in the United States seems to be focused on Lance's quest to tie Miguel Indurain's record of 5 consecutive wins and then also on Tyler Hamilton's success despite his injuries, there have been other subplots involving the great stage wins by other riders. What has been your favorite among those so far?
Well, I think the stage to Alpe d'Huez was a classic stage. A Spanish rider named Iban Mayo, from the Euskaltel team from the Spanish Basque Country, won that stage. It was a spectacular stage. It was the first summit finish of this year's Tour. And Mayo gave us everyone a preview that Armstrong wasn't going to be quite as strong as he has been the last 4 years in a row. He went on an aggressive attack. Normally Armstrong in that kind of epic stage rises to the occasion and can usually wins the stage. But we saw that day that Armstrong showed that he wasn't going to be as strong as he has been. Mayo won the stage. Armstrong came in with the other favorites, but he lost a little time, and everyone said, this could be an interesting Tour.
If Armstrong does go on to win this time, he has the possibility to become the champion forever if he breaks Indurain's record. What are the chances that happens?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, actually. No rider has actually won more than 5 Tours. It seems to be mathematically very difficult to get beyond that. Armstrong has shown this year that the 5th Tour wasn't so easy, so maybe the 6th could be impossible, even for Armstrong. Miguel Indurain, who won 5 in a row, the only rider to win 5 in a row, he went into the 6th Tour as the favorite. He had won a big race in June. He looked untouchable. And then he finished well off the pace and didn't win the 6th and retired.
All right. We've danced around the obvious question now for quite some time. Who's going to win this thing?
I think Lance is going to win. I think it's going to come down to perhaps maybe Ulrich can win today. But I think he won't be able to take out a minute, 5 seconds on Armstrong. In the last 4 years in a row, Armstrong has won the final time trial every year. So he has that in his pocket. And I think Armstrong has overcome his problems he had earlier in the race. So I think Lance will be able to pull it off.
Andy Hood is covering the Tour for Velo News. He spoke to us from France. Andy, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Merci.
Bob Uecker has a ticket back to the front row. Tomorrow he will receive the Ford C. Frick Broadcasting Award at the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Cooperstown usually excludes guys with career batting averages of 200, but Uecker has had success since his playing days ended. Wisconsin Public Radio's Chuck Quirnbach reports.
Bob Uecker has been broadcasting Milwaukee Brewers games for about 30 years. Uecker was at the microphone when the Brewers got no respect from fans, opposing teams, and even umpires for much of the 1970s.
Bando is really hot at Durwood Merrill. That's a brutal call, and I don't care what they say.
Uecker was also there in 1982 when the Brewers had their most successful year.
Ben Oblaby coming on. He's waiting. He's waiting. He's got it, and the Brewers win the Eastern Division Championship.
Many fans say Uecker not only has an exciting style, they also laugh with him and at him. Uecker developed a comedy persona based on his mediocre playing career as a catcher, or Catcher in the Rye, that's W-R-Y, as Uecker titled his autobiography. Some of Uecker's fans are so devoted, they even wear headset radios to Miller Park and listen to Uecker's radio calls. One such fan named Dave says Euchre has brightened many a contest.
Some of his older humor, like his pass ball school and just some of his career batting average, stuff like that, he makes fun of.
Hollywood noticed long ago that people laugh at Bob Euchre. Johnny Carson had Euchre on The Tonight Show dozens of times, and Euchre was a regular on the TV series Mr. Belvedere. He also appeared in a few movies, most notably the comedy Major League.
Vaughn into the windup in his first offering. Just a bit outside. He tried the corner and missed.
Euchre has avoided controversy for most of his announcing career, but for a time he irritated some recovering alcoholics with jokes about the use of liquor and the occasional reference to the bottom of a fifth. So it perhaps came as no surprise when Euchre became one of the television ad pitchmen for Milwaukee-based Miller Brewing.
Good seats, huh?
You're in the wrong seat, buddy. Come on.
Oh, I must be in the front row.
Come on.
Light beer from Miller. Everything you always wanted in a beer, and less.
Good seats, hey, buddy? He missed the tag! He missed the tag!
In that commercial, Euchre was banished to the upper deck of the stadium. In the upper deck at Miller Park, the Brewers have named their obstructed view seats after Euchre and charge $1 to sit in them. On one recent night, a fan named Todd strained to see around two huge pillars. He said the Euchre seats are appropriately priced and named.
That's where the obstructed view came in. I didn't see what the play finished off being.
But for all the fan adoration and fun, Bob Euchre takes a serious approach to clowning around.
You know what? I don't think I could ever work any other way. You know, I think people expect that of me. And I think I expect that of myself. There's a time to be serious. I don't mess around too much when we have a good game going. But, you know, if we're getting our brains beat out or somebody else is getting theirs beat out, I think there's a time for a little humor and to keep people happy and keep them tuned in, for one thing.
These days, the Brewers' play on the field will test anyone's sense of humor. Now Euchre has come full circle and once again finds himself announcing for a losing team.
Inning over, Brewers get a run unearned on one hit, one error, leave one, five and a half complete, 6-1, Pittsburgh.
But Euchre claims the Brewers are heading in the right direction. This weekend, though, Euchre gets a break from the team as he accepts the Ford C. Frick Broadcasting Award and attains baseball immortality at the Hall of Fame.
The honor is tremendous, but the weekend of camaraderie and telling stories that get bigger and bigger every year, they weren't that big when they started, but they sure do get bigger and bigger every year. That's what I'm looking forward to.
The 68-year-old Euchre also says he plans to go on and on as the Brewers announcer. Or, as he puts it in his famous home run call, Euchre hopes it'll be a long time before he's told to...
Get out of here, baby. Get out of here. Go on, way out of here.
For Only a Game, I'm Chuck Kornbach in Milwaukee.
Cooper got it all. A three-run blast for Cooper.
Fly ball hit the deep center. Get out of here for Joshua. Hey, get out of here, ball. It's gone. Straight away center about 15 rows back.
It's 18 minutes past the hour.
With a little bit of luck, with a little bit of luck.
It was a very big deal indeed when Ben Curtis, a rookie on the Pro Golfers Tour, won the British Open last weekend, especially for Kevin Foster. Foster, a cab driver from Sittingbourne, Kent, won £217,000 by making several wagers on Curtis at odds ranging from 33-1 to 750-1. I decided there was no value in the odds on Tiger Woods, Foster explained, so I plunged on Ben. It was all very nerve-wracking. As far as I'm concerned, Ben Curtis is a really great bloke and a gutsy golfer. Kevin Foster, who says he's never previously bet on golf, has said he'll donate £25,000 of his winnings to Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children.
I'm Steve Brown with the sports headlines. In yesterday's American League action, the New York Yankees edged the Boston Red Sox 4-3. The Royals barbecued the Tigers 8-3. Minnesota downed Cleveland 6-5. Toronto bested Baltimore 5-3. And Chicago drained Tampa Bay 7-2. Elsewhere, Oakland held Anaheim at bay by a score of 3-2. And Seattle toppled Texas 11-5. For Only a Game, I'm Steve Brown in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce weighs in on the sports news of the week. But first, on Saturday, July 24th, 1993, Boston area listeners tuned in to WBUR and heard Only a Game's inaugural program. Over the course of that first half hour, topics included the New England Patriots' possible move from Foxborough, Massachusetts to Hartford, Connecticut, a San Diego Padres fire sale, and a weird little essay entitled, Why Are We Doing This? But the most memorable story which ran that steamy July day was a feature on Bill Lee's barnstorming New England Gray Sox, a collection of former major leaguers which had landed in Cape Cod to play the Cape League's Falmouth Commodores and to raise money for charity. There was much zaniness, camaraderie, and goodwill, but also a challenge leveled at Lee by a future major leaguer who would, 9 years later, help his team win the World Series. We reprise that story for you now.
And I'm thankful that I got to pitch for the Red Sox for as long as I did. My dad said, you're Irish, you're Catholic, and you drink a lot. You're going to go far in the Red Sox organization.
Fans remember former Red Sox left-hander Bill Lee because he once called his manager, Don Zimmer, a gerbil. They remember him because when then-Commissioner Bowie Kuhn sent two gentlemen in suits to question Lee about his alleged use of marijuana, Lee told them he liked to sprinkle the herb on his pancakes for breakfast before running into Fenway Park from his Belmont home. He claimed the dope helped cut the exhaust fumes as he ran. And finally, lots of fans remember Lee for one pitch he threw in the 1975 World Series. It was an artistically pleasing pitch, a lazy-looking parabola of a pitch, an altogether splendidly silly pitch that Tony Perez hit about 11 miles. Which disaster never laid a glove on Lee. He left Boston as the second winningest left-hander the club had ever employed. He was banished, Lee's word, to Montreal for a utility infielder named Stan Pappy, and then banished, Lee's word again, from Montreal and the rest of Major League Baseball for bolting the club when the Expos canned his pal, Rodney Scott. Much of the above might lead the casual observer to conclude that 119 major league wins notwithstanding, Lee was temperamentally unsuited for the game. These days, Lee might even agree, at least if you were talking about the game as the Red Sox play it. That's why he's invented another game altogether, an amalgam of an old-timers game, charity exhibition game, and barnstorming tour.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, sports fans everywhere, the guests today are the New England Gray Sox.
Lee's vehicle these days is the New England Gray Sox, the stars of which include former major leaguers Jim Lonborg, Bernie Carbo, George Foster, and Ozzie Virgil Jr. But the centerpiece is still Lee, the spaceman himself. We caught up with the Gray Sox in Falmouth before a game they'd scheduled against the Cape Cod League Commodores. The town was prepared. From a nursing home, there hung a sign that read, Welcome Gray Sox, though the oldest member of Lee's squad, Dalton Jones, is not quite 50. We were greeted at the gate by an Australian woman selling T-shirts advertising the team's first annual farewell tour and featuring one of Lee's credos on the back.
He says, being on the mound puts one in a relaxed state of super consciousness. Line drives float to the mound in slow motion. It's zen-like. You're the ball and the ball is you. It can do you no harm. For hours after the game, this sense of completeness lingers. Then you sink back to what we humorously refer to as reality.
3 hours before game time, members of the Commodores are watering down the infield dirt. Adults in lounge chairs have claimed places in the shade under the trees in the foul territory beyond left field. Children of all ages run in aimless circles along both baselines, looking up occasionally to see if anyone new in a Gray Sox uniform has appeared.
So as soon as Mr. Bill Lee can give us some direction at the press box here, we can direct the youngsters to the proper locations to start the clinic.
The entertainment begins with a clinic run by Lee for pitchers, or hitters, or anyone with a sense of humor.
When you're finished with this game, I want you all to run back to your houses. And on the way, find 2 5-pound rocks. Because when I come up in the morning, after I stretch, I grab rocks, and I go down and get the mail, and I go like this. And I go like this all the time. What does that do? It builds my upper body. So it gets all the stiffness out. Yes.
The clinic is supposed to involve baseballs, but there are none in evidence, except for the 1,100 or so that people are proffering to Lee and his teammates for autographs, a circumstance that threatens at least once to turn the eclectic Lee's attention from baseball to politics, ecology, and the fall of the empire.
See, people would rather collect stuff than learn stuff, and that's the problem with our planet. The object of life is to learn, not to collect, because collecting is something that's
you can lose. And if you lose something, then you feel bad.
Lee signs anyway, of course, as do nearly all of his teammates, though some let their attention wander a little from the task at hand. Starting pitcher Jim Lonborg is dressed in a Gray Sox uniform and cap, but he can't entirely forget that in real life now, he's a dentist.
How you doing?
You're about ready to lose that tooth, aren't you? Doesn't that drive you crazy?
Some of the hitters Lonborg will face a little later in the afternoon don't look much older than the boy with the loose teeth, but they are all college ball players, most of them hoping to sign professional contracts. They say all the right things about facing former major leaguers.
I probably won't be able to hit his fastball, but maybe a slower pitch I can be able to hit.
This man's almost 50 years old. I believe you probably could hit his fastball.
Well, we'll have to see.
If he leaves it up, I'm going to hit it. I love the high pitch, and I'm going to swing at it if he leaves it up there.
Well, I'm not going to get it up. Wind's blowing out. This is a very dangerous part. Fear is a great, you know, equalizer because it creates adrenaline, and adrenaline creates good sinkers, and good sinkers create ground balls.
The standard baseball talk is a little misleading because on this day, not much else is standard. Gray Sox catcher Ossie Virgil has forgotten his equipment and has to borrow some from the other team's receiver. Popular former Red Sox manager Joe Morgan is listed in the program and announced over the PA system as the guest skipper for the Commodores, but Morgan is having none of that.
I'm not managing. I'm throwing out the first ball, and I'm watching. I don't know who said I was the manager, but I'm just watching.
Bernie Cabo, please report to the batting cage.
And then there is Bernie Carbo, or rather there isn't. Carbo assured his immortality among Red Sox fans by hitting the 1975 World Series home run, without which Carlton Fisk's knock couldn't have happened, and by carrying along on road trips a stuffed gorilla named Mighty Joe Young. Carbo has been one of the headliners for Bill Lee's side, but he is conspicuously absent as his teammates take batting practice. Finally, smiling vaguely, several ill-placed pounds over his playing weight, Bernie turns up in the Gray Sox dugout about 10 well-considered minutes beyond the point where there is any danger that he'll have to handle a bat.
My batting practice days are over with. I'm 45 years old.
Tell us why.
I entertain people.
Good.
I got to entertain, sign autographs, and talk to everybody.
Did you like that?
I love it.
Yay.
Carbo's real function becomes clear in the moments before the game's first pitch. He represents the Gray Sox in the conference at home plate when the umpires go over the ground rules and offers some amendments of his own.
They're very young. We're very, very old.
Are you saying their strike zone's a little bigger than
yours? They got two strikes on them. Anything close to the plate is strike three. And then we got two strikes, nothing strike three.
Right, Joe?
Good luck, Brennan. Good to see you.
The game itself is a delight in the manner of the barnstorming appearances of showmen such as Satchel Paige and Babe Ruth. Jim Lonborg pitches two scoreless innings for the Gray Sox, then opens the third by throwing a ball over the backstop. His teenage son, dressed in a copy of Dad's uniform, sprints from the dugout to remove his father, and the elder Lonborg gesticulates passionately, pretending to be outraged at the quick hook. This is Bill Lee's signal to begin walking to the mound, which is, of course, what the crowd has been waiting for. True to his promise, he mows down three straight Commodores on curveballs. Later, the Commodores will touch Lee for a few runs, but not until the Gray Sox have padded the lead they established in the first inning on a couple of hits and some creative base running. The game ends 7-3, Gray Sox. Winning pitcher, Lee. The old guys remain undefeated, which is nearly beside the point, the essence of which Gray Sox catcher Ossie Virgil had provided with a shrug before the game began.
I guess you just got to get on board and take a ride with them to the moon with them every now and then to be on part of this crew.
It's tempting to say of this midsummer day game between a collection of former major leaguers and a team full of kids hoping to achieve that designation someday that a good time was had by all. And it is true that a good time was had by many. There were hot dogs and there was popcorn. There were plenty of laughs and there was some pretty fair baseball, too. But for at least one of the participants, perhaps inevitably, the event could not live up to the dream that had inspired it. Bill Lee himself, the fellow without whom Jim Lonborg would have been examining molars and Bernie Carbo would have been late to something else entirely that afternoon, was feeling a little empty.
But I wanted to use old-time uniforms and authentic parts, Cape Cod parts, and kind of make it that nostalgia thing. But it just seems to, modern-day signing autographs seems to jump up. So you, when you get down here, the more people are here, you have less time to put on the event. And it's a double-edged sword, and I'm finding out that it's difficult to satisfy what you want to do when you try to satisfy everybody else.
The gap between the old-time dream and the autograph grab, which too many have made of this appearance of the Gray Sox, might discourage a lesser visionary. but it won't keep Bill Lee down. He likes pitching too much. He likes talking about it, too, and laughing about it. And then there's always trying to hit, even though he can't see, and running, because he says his legs are still good, and showing all those people what fun baseball can be when you learn to relax and enjoy it and lift rocks. And if the uniforms are double-knit instead of flannel, and the atmosphere is the hooting and hollering of kids and their shameless parents running from one investment opportunity to the next, rather than the hush that should accompany the worship with which Lee still regards his game, well, perhaps it's because on Earth, where there is gravity, even at the ballpark, the best we can hope for is that the brave and mighty dream will provide us with a good show before it fades.
July 28, 1993. Dear WBUR, I thoroughly enjoyed the first week of Only a Game. It was great to get to know Bill Lee a little better. Keep up the great work. Gratefully, A. Dix Leeson, Jr., Needham, Massachusetts.
Thus ran one of the first letters generated by the fledgling program that Only a Game was 10 years ago. The trickle of mail soon became a veritable drip.
To WBUR. My thoughts on It's Only a Game... Since it's only a game, why talk about it? Please restore James Isaacs to a noon starting, or I'll be switching the channel. Carolyn Cronin, Brookline, Massachusetts.
When we got that one, we had to wonder what led Ms. Cronin to think only a game would displace James Isaacs. We love the guy, who was then hosting a weekend pop show here at WBUR, and in the guise of George Carter from down Norwood there, he's been on the show lots of times.
Silly coach, screaming. The call stands. You change nothing, but your hat explodes!
Anyway, support began coming our way from folks who might not have been aware of all the good sports stories, or any sports stories, had it not been for Only a Game.
Dear WBUR, thank you for giving Bill Littlefield a feature with Only a Game. I have added it to my listening list. I'm not a sports freak, but Bill's commentary falls pleasantly on the ear. Thanks again, Evan Suits, Lancaster, Massachusetts.
As an Only a Game listener declaring that he wasn't really a sports fan, Evan had lots of company, the people we had in mind when we decided good stories told well would find a wide audience, even if the stories were set in sports. Most listeners reserve judgment on the show for at least a few weeks, but others, for reasons that soon became apparent, got in touch right away. For example, this fellow who addressed his letter to Only a Game's original senior producer.
Dear David Green, I very much enjoyed your new show's maiden voyage this afternoon. I'm writing to inquire about the possibility of participating in the program in the capacity of writer, commentator, correspondent, etc., etc. I have been writing about the various cultural, political, and social issues surrounding the world of sport for several years.
This job applicant couldn't be blamed for not knowing the staff consisted of three guys sharing an office so small that at all times one of us had to be out somewhere taping something. He saved his most cogent argument for employment for the final paragraph of his letter.
P.S. By the way, I should also mention that I am a longtime poker-playing buddy of your friends, Carl and Adam, and over the years, I have heard various accounts of your Halcyon Montclair poker-playing exploits.
The obvious threat to reveal all about Mr. Green's dark and calamitous past availed the job seeker nothing. Integrity, thy name was only a game, at least at the outset. Maybe that's why a lot of the mail we received was from women.
Dear Mr. Littlefield, I can't thank you enough for giving time on your show to women's and girls' sports and coverage that is serious, interested, and interesting. I'm almost 40, listening to this kind of coverage for the first time in my life. Think of all the kids, girls and boys, who get to grow up with this. You are to be congratulated. Diane Daly, Lexington, Massachusetts.
What Ms. Daly may not have realized is how much easier and how much more pleasant it is to cover women's and girls' sports. General managers of women's teams tend to return phone calls, even when they come from hosts of new programs, and female athletes rarely chew tobacco and spit the juice on your shoes. Since we were a startup 10 years ago, it was no surprise that some of the early letters contained suggestions for story ideas, potential guests, and more.
Dear Bill Littlefield, P-E-R-F-E-C-T. That's my comment on your new show. The concept, the content, and the duration are all so appropriate to your keen, deprecating sense of humor. Please, though, do not extend the length of the show. As good as it is, as much material as there is out there for you to prick with your agile mind, a half hour sates my need for your sane view of sports and leaves me longing for next week's edition. Besides, I have to get off my duff and spray my apple trees. Sincerely, Doc Porter, Temple, New Hampshire.
We followed that advice right up until we figured out that NPR had no use for a show that didn't run an hour. Sorry, Doc. I hope the apple trees have made it through the last decade anyway. I think despite the unwavering support of the station, some of us, okay, I, must have betrayed a certain desperation in those early days, hence letters like this one.
Dear Mr. Littlefield, as I listened to the close of your program this morning and heard you give the station's address, I had this insecure feeling that it was a sort of a request for support of your program. Since I listen to it most Saturday mornings and have been a fan of your features for some time, I thought I better act on my gut reaction. Commentators like you capture the true essence of what sports should be in our society, and I, for one, would hate to lose you. With great appreciation, Paul Cantor, Framingham, Massachusetts.
To all those who wrote only a game 10 years ago, or who have written since, thank you for your good cheer, your suggestions, your corrections, and your encouragement. Thanks also to those of you writing and listening still. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. We live at WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. And you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company, with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment. On the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Senior citizens dance in Miami's Little Havana. Horns blare in the bombed-out streets of Kosovo. And steel drums ring below Broadway on a New York subway platform. I'm Scott Simon. These sounds of our world on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Steve Brown with these sports headlines. In yesterday's National League action, Montreal overcame Atlanta 9-8. The Mets stymied Cincinnati 3-1. Florida foiled Philadelphia 11-5. Chicago beat Houston 5-3. And Pittsburgh doubled up St. Louis 10-5. Elsewhere, Colorado vanquished Milwaukee 7-3. Arizona edged Los Angeles 2-1. And San Francisco stopped San Diego 5-2. For Only a Game, I'm Steve Brown in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a conversation with Major League pitcher-slash-manager-turned-author Larry Durker. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me for a discussion of the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
And most importantly, Hawaiian shirt devotee. Yeah.
And before we discuss the week's sports news, I want to thank you.
You're welcome.
For being an important part of our program for the last 10 years and for putting up with your colleagues' ridicule for being on this namby-pamby sports radio program for NPR.
They all secretly listen to it in little transistor radios under their pillows, and they wish they could write in haiku.
The San Francisco Giants are on an amazing run. They now find themselves geometrically increasing their lead in the National League West. I guess all the team needed was for Dusty Baker and Jeff Kent to find someplace else to work.
Well, this was a very, very well put together ball club. And I think, you know, Dusty Baker is certainly doing a fine job with the Chicago Cubs. But basically what's happening is Barry Bonds is asserting again his claim to be the greatest baseball player who ever lived. He's now got 646 career homers, leading off the bottom of the ninth after saving a run with a throw in a game in which they beat their principal rivals, the Arizona Diamondbacks. I mean, there is no question that he's the greatest player after 35 in the history of baseball, and I think that probably he's going to finish up being the greatest baseball player who ever lived.
Ken Griffey Jr. is rehabilitating again, this time from a torn tendon in his ankle. He says he'll be back, but given all the injuries that he's suffered over the past 3 years, maybe he's a 33-year-old who ought to be looking for another line of work.
The great quote was, "I'm 30, but I'll come back. The shoulder's not that bad. The ankle's going to heal." I mean, you talk about be careful what you wish for. There are several other joints in the body he hasn't injured. But remarkably, this was the guy that people were saying prior to his trade back to Cincinnati in February of 2000, who had a chance to be the greatest player of all time. And right now, he's not even the second or third greatest player of his era.
Right.
He's probably going to get voted into the Hall of Fame, although those are discussions I do not have, as you know.
The amount of distance
that Barry Bonds has put between he and Ken Griffey Jr. now is really remarkable.
Charlie, only one baseball team, the New York Yankees, has a payroll so high that it will be penalized under baseball's luxury tax rule. That wouldn't have been the team that you would have guessed might qualify for that distinction, would it?
Well, it took was Armando Benitez to get the Yankee payroll to $180.3 million, which means they will be paying a bill of $10.8 million at the end of January of next year. Which will not matter. It'll be written off somewhere in George Steinbrenner's vast wilderness of accountants somewhere, and the Yankees will be a good baseball team.
If only one team is spending so much that it has to pay that luxury tax, can the tax be working as a way to give the have-a-lot teams a better shot at competing with the have-even-more teams?
No, because it's an artificial gimmick, and it's always been an artificial gimmick. It is an artificial gimmick put in place to deal with what is essentially, regardless of how many people now believe otherwise, now given the popularity of the book Moneyball, it's an artificial gimmick put in place to deal with an artificial financial crisis. So no, it's not enough to achieve competitive balance as that mythical beast that supposedly existed in baseball at one time or another. And the Yankees are simply going to write a check.
Last week, we talked a little bit about NBA players who'll be wearing different uniforms come fall. This week, the number of that lot increased through the so-called sign and trade. Which clubs, if any, are suddenly much better?
Well, there's no question that the Minnesota Timberwolves are more interesting now. They have managed to acquire, in no particular order, Michael Olajuwon from the Clippers, Latrell Sprewell from the Knicks, Sam Cassell from the Bucks. They already have Wally Szczerbiak and Kevin Garnett. This is now, I don't know, if anybody can figure out exactly what kind of team Kevin McHale is building out there, I wish they'd call me, because you've got now four guys who really need to shoot, and Michael Olajuwon, who can rebound, and boy, is he going to get a workout doing that. I can't believe that they're done. There's no way that Wally Szczerbiak's going to be on that team at the beginning of the year. The other thing in that incredible four-team NBA trade that was made last Wednesday was Keith Van Horn going to New York. Now, there used to be an old comedy movie, I don't know if you remember it, with Jack Lemmon and Sandy Dennis called The Out-of-Towners.
Sure.
Where they go to New York and all kinds of bad things,
awful
and they just
things.
Get overwhelmed. That is now the Keith Van Horn story. You talk about somebody who has absolutely no chance of succeeding in that media market. Keith Van Horn is Exhibit A.
The Milwaukee Bucks may or may not be better next season, but they'll have a new coach, which apparently came as a terrific surprise to George Karl.
Well, it came as a surprise to everyone. Very rarely do you see a coach dispatched in the middle of the summer. I saw George Karl at the Reebok Summer League here in Boston a couple of weeks ago, sitting by the sidelines watching his lottery pick TJ Ford and a couple of picks from last year. And he looked like he was quite content and ready to go. And now he's out of a job. But he is, and always has been, one of those NBA coaches that has a very distinct and very easily defined shelf life with people like his players and his owners.
In a warm and fuzzy sort of basketball story, John Wooden, who was so remarkably successful as a coach at UCLA for so long, received the Presidential Medal of Freedom on Wednesday. And when he first heard about this honor that was going to be coming his way, Wooden thought it was a hoax, which perhaps says something about his humility.
Well, it also says something about how shrewd he is. He didn't really believe it till he got it in writing on White House stationery. No flies on John.
Susie Whaley's first-round performance at the Greater Hartford Open all but guaranteed that she would not make the cut, but she has gained many admirers. In the post-Annika at the Colonial World, what purpose does the continuing presence of female golfers at PGA events serve beyond everybody kind of feeling good?
Isn't that enough?
It's enough for me.
It's certainly enough for me. As was pointed out in the Associated Press story, she did finish ahead of David Duval, among other people.
Way ahead of David Duval. And there was a lovely moment where, having had a kind of ho-hum round, she sunk a very long putt for a birdie on the 18th hole. So at least we have to commend her for her sense of drama.
Yeah, not just that, but I mean, I really do believe the whole Annika episode down at the Colonial was helpful to Susie Whaley. It really did sort of like lift all the hype.
Finally, Charlie, on Tuesday, Sean P. Diddy Combs announced his desire to purchase the New York Knicks, quote, because it's not going down right now. I wasn't aware the team was for sale, were you?
Well, I think P. Diddy is confusing the owner with the coach. You don't fire the owner because the team isn't winning. It doesn't work that way. I think the event itself would be wonderful. I mean, the guy, regardless of what you may think of his musical abilities, understands the entertainment industry. And by God, opening night would be something to see.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. Of course, he joins me each week to comment on the week's sports news. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill, and shout out to my homies. For the return of the dawn, the world in my palm. My mom calls me Sean, but y'all call me. The B, the I, the D, the G, the Y, the G, the I, the G is Diddy.
On Monday, in the Turks and Caicos Islands, Tanya Streeter, with whom I spoke on last week's program, succeeded in breaking free diving's variable ballast record with a 400-foot plunge, hence setting her 8th overall world record in free diving. Streeter is the first free diver, male or female, to break all four of her sports records: constant weight, free immersion, no limits, and variable ballast. Following her successful dive, Tanya Streeter said, "I have surpassed my own expectations, and I'm excited about inspiring other free divers to break this record." As a pitcher with the Houston Astros from 1964 through 1977, Larry Durker won 139 games. As the manager of the Houston Astros, he won 4 division championships in 5 seasons. In a retirement he doesn't seem entirely ready to accept, he's written This Ain't Brain Surgery, subtitled How to Win the Pennant Without Losing Your Mind. Larry Durker joins me now from the studios of KUHF in Houston. Larry, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you, Bill.
One thing that may surprise some readers of this book is that as a player, as a broadcaster, and as a manager, you didn't like spring training. And I wonder if you could have acknowledged that while you were still employed by the Astros, or for a baseball man, would that have been like coming out against motherhood and apple pie?
Well, it might be, but I did acknowledge that when I was broadcasting, because I didn't think it was necessary to broadcast every single spring training game and for all four of us to travel, you know, sometimes 2 or 3 hours just to do half of a game, because I felt that anybody that would listen to a spring training game was probably going to buy tickets anyway.
They were already in the fold. They didn't have to be convinced.
But as a manager, I didn't complain about that. It was long. I knew it was going to be long. But as a player, I was a pitcher. So the only days I stayed for the game were the days that I pitched. So most days I was off at 12 or, you know, come out there about 9 in the morning and be done by noon or 1 o'clock. And I like that.
You managed the Astros from 97 through 2001, and at several points in the book, when you discuss the relationship between manager and players, you indicate that even a very good manager's impact can be minimal since players so often pay no attention to him at all. It makes it sound like a very frustrating job.
It is frustrating, you know, and also what happens is that by the time you get to the major leagues, you think you know everything, and I don't think it's in the book, but I've said on a number of occasions that I feel like there's about four stages of a big league player and his relationship to coaches and the manager. The first stage is when you first come up and you think they know everything and you do whatever they tell you to do. And then the second stage is when you think that maybe they're making some mistakes here and there. And the third stage is when you think you know way more than any of them know and that they're all stupid and they should run the game the way you would like to run it. And then if you're able to last long enough, say 10 to 15 years, you begin to realize that it's not that easy.
And they're smarter than you thought all along. Kind of like kids with their parents, isn't it?
Sure. It's just like when you get your car, you know, and start driving around, chasing all over town. Your parents don't know anything. But by the time you get out of college and start a family, all of a sudden they seem a lot smarter than they used to be.
You write at one point that when you started out as a manager, you thought you could really make a difference, but that, quote, I never really came close to winning over the players to my way of thinking. Was that your problem specifically, or is that just how it is with most managers today?
No, I think that was partly my problem. I think somebody that had a little more salesmanship might have been able to do a little better. I'm pretty low-key, and I'd mention things and watch guys and try to talk to him one-on-one and tell him what I was thinking about different plays and strategies. But I didn't really get on the soapbox and start trying to preach. And there probably are some guys that have the personality for that would have been able to make more progress than I. But even in that case, most guys, by the time they get up to the major leagues, have played so much baseball and for so many coaches that they're pretty set in their ways. It's hard to convince them that there's a different way. In fact, as I mentioned in the book, on some of the things, it was hard for me even to get my coaches to believe that there was another way to do it.
You write that when you moved from the broadcast booth to the bench in Houston, you were not the most qualified guy within the Astros organization for the job, a very candid thing for you to say in this book. Did the players feel that way as well?
Well, they didn't talk to me about it, but I'm sure they felt that Matt Galante would have been a better choice because he'd been with the team so long and he'd had many years of managing at the AAA level and had been successful. He's one of those guys that can get along with everybody, and all the players loved him and still do. But I also know that there were a couple of coaches that we had when I was playing that were well-loved by the team until they became manager. And then shortly after they became manager, the guys didn't like him that much anymore.
I should mention that the title of the book alludes to the fact that following a seizure in the dugout while you were managing the Astros, you had surgery to untangle some blood vessels in your brain. You write that your recovery was swift and complete enough so that you actually began to get impatient when folks would ask about your health, but I gather you are healthy now.
I'm healthy now, and I was playing golf within a week after coming out of the hospital in that brain surgery. I was really amazed that they could do something of that impact, to actually cut your head open and operate on your brain, and that you could come out of that with almost no recovery time. But that's the way it worked.
You make a remarkable admission, I think, when you acknowledge that you didn't really want the Astros to do too well after you were replaced as a manager. Most ex-managers would just mumble the appropriate cliches about wishing the boys the best.
Well, I did wish them the best until they started getting hot in August. And I found myself maybe not pulling against them wholeheartedly, but not being that concerned if they failed, because one of the things that happened right after I was let go is that they let Moises Alou go as a free agent and Vinny Castilla, Mike Jackson, and Mike Williams. So they let four excellent veteran players go. And we won 93 games the year before, and it would be very unlikely that they would do that anyway, but when they got up over 500 and only a game out of first place in August, I started to worry about it. If they had a really unbelievable finish, it would make it look like I hadn't done a very good job. And I didn't like feeling that way, but honestly, that's how I felt. And now this year, they're in first place and seem to be headed for contention all the way to the end. And I don't feel that way anymore.
Despite the frustrations of managing, some of which we've discussed, you seem to be saying at the end of the book that you'd welcome the opportunity to return to the bench. Why hasn't the phone rung for a guy who won 4 division titles in 5 years?
I don't really know. I think probably because I haven't applied. I would imagine that when a team lets a manager go, that a guy that wants to be a manager, if he's had some experience, would call and ask for an interview. And I haven't done that. I'm still a little surprised that nobody has given me a call.
Before leaving the Astros, you really had been a baseball lifer, over 30 years in the game. Are you having any trouble filling your summer days?
No, I haven't. Well, a little. Not a lot. I've been doing some things to get me outside, like working out and playing golf. And then when I'm inside, I've been doing a lot of reading, and I've been doing a lot of writing. I've got another manuscript that's already longer than the first one, and it's underway and probably only 2/3 finished. If I don't have anything I have to do, I'll invent something.
Larry Durker, formerly a broadcaster and manager for the Houston Astros, is the author of This Ain't Brain Surgery, published by Simon & Schuster. Larry, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had letter reading help this week from Christine Fischera, Walter Dixon, Susan Levin, Kirsten Kalkhurst, Glenn Alexander, Paul Levinson, and Darren Manoogian. We also had help from Paul Franklin at KUHF in Houston. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or learn more about Larry Durker's new book, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Bill Lee, who else, who offered 10 years ago his formula for success.
Find 2 5-pound rocks, and I go down and get the mail, and I go like this.
We have found those rocks and other rocks as well, and it has worked. So here's to another decade of carrying rocks, getting the mail, and telling stories. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.